Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Think of episodic novels with strong-willed, eccentric characters at their heart, and you might think of Don Quixote or Tom Jones, or now of Olive Kittredge, a big, blunt, prickly woman, a force of nature in a small town on the coast of Maine, and the main character and namesake of the book that has just won Elizabeth Strout the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. This hour, On Point, we'll talk with Elizabeth Strout about human nature, that salty Maine coast, and her novel, In Stories, Olive Kittredge. You can join the conversation. Have you gotten to know Olive Kittredge? Does a small town in a hard place make the bones of life more visible, more real? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Elizabeth Strout. Her earlier novels are Abide With Me and Amy and Isabel. She teaches writing at Queen's University in Charlotte, North Carolina, lived as a girl in Durham, New Hampshire, and Harpswell, Maine, born in Portland, lives now in New York. Her latest book, Olive Kittredge, just won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. The Pulitzer Board said the stories in Olive Kittredge pack a cumulative emotional wallop. The New Yorker says Strout animates the ordinary with an astonishing force. The San Francisco Chronicle calls her character, Olive Kittredge, a compelling life force, a red-blooded original. Elizabeth Strout, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's lovely. Thank you.
It's wonderful. And congratulations right off. You had a field out there with John Updike, no less, and Philip Roth in it. You were up against, Louise Erdrich in The Plague of Doves. We spoke with her in Christine Schutz's All Souls, and now you're in the company of Harper Lee and William Faulkner and Ernest Hemingway. Hey, way to go.
Just wonderful. Yes, thank you.
Way to go. Congratulations. I'm struck in everybody's comments about the book, and it's this wonderful collection of stories, which are in their way a novel, an episodic novel, but I quoted some of it right there with this word, force. Everybody talks about force, the force of Olive Kittredge. Is that you? Yeah. Is that your doppelganger? Is that what you long to be, that forceful for good and ill?
Well, I think in all my characters, there's always a part of myself. And writing Olive, I was especially allowed the fiction of thinking, well, this isn't me. But, of course, there's a great deal of myself in the rawest form, I think, taken to the furthest edge of the table.
Does writing fiction make you feel more forceful, more powerful?
I don't really think about myself as I'm writing. It's an unconscious thing. I know that the process of writing, when it goes well, there's nothing like it. It's an exhilaration that's just huge. When it doesn't go well, then the despair is rather huge too. But it's not so much a sense of powerfulness as I'm writing as much as true joy, I think.
But it is power, isn't it? Power to sort of crack open human condition in a way we're not normally willing to speak of, a power to illuminate hearts. I mean, that moves like a shaman moves.
Exactly. It's really, and that's what the training of a fiction writer is about too, is to find those sentences that will reverberate with the sound that, you know, gives dignity to our most primitive feelings. So there's that training that goes into it to finally be able to get in there to record those aspects of ourselves that we may have forgotten about.
You've got strong characters in Olive Kittredge. Some are sweet. Her husband, Henry Kittredge, he's a pharmacist. And the place itself is important in your book. I'd be grateful if you'd read just a bit from us, right from the top of the very first story, Pharmacy, just to get us set with this, with one of your characters, but to be set in Maine. Could you read just an opening graph there?
Absolutely. For many years, Henry Kittredge was a pharmacist in the next town over, driving every morning on snowy roads or rainy roads or summertime roads when the wild raspberries shot their new growth in brambles along the last section of town before he turned off to where the wider road led to the pharmacy. Retired now, he still wakes early and remembers how mornings used to be his favorite, as though the world were his secret. Tires rumbling softly beneath him, and the light emerging through the early fog, the brief sight of the bay off to his right, then the pines, tall and slender, and almost always he rode with the window partly open, because he loved the smell of the pines and the heavy salt air, and in the winter he loved the smell of the cold.
Hey, you're a good reader. Elizabeth Strout reading from Olive Kittredge. So there it's kind of bucolic, and it's that mane and the smell and the heavy salt air and all that. If I may impose to have you leap just a few pages forward in the same story where it gets a little more messy. He's kind of falling for a young woman he's hired at the pharmacy to help him out there, Denise. And here he is beginning a new week, asking her about her weekend, and then a little insight into it's not exactly bucolic, but it's very domestic in the tough way. How about a read there, Elizabeth?
Absolutely. On a Monday morning when the air in the pharmacy held a sharp chill, he went about opening up the store saying, "How was your weekend, Denise?" Olive had refused to go to church the day before, and Henry uncharacteristically had spoken to her sharply. "Is it too much to ask?" he had found himself saying as he stood in the kitchen in his undershorts ironing his trousers. "A man's wife accompanying him to church?" Going without her seemed a public exposure of familial failure. "Yes, it is most certainly is too goddamn much to ask," Olive had answered. Her fury's door flung open. "You have no idea how tired I am teaching all day, going to foolish meetings where the goddamn principal is a moron, shopping, cooking, ironing, laundry, doing Christopher's homework with him, and you!" She had grabbed onto the back of a dining room chair, and her dark hair, still uncombed from its nice night's disarrangement, had fallen across her eyes. "You, Mr. Head Deacon Claptrap Nice Guy, expect me to give up my Sunday mornings and go sit among a bunch of snotwats." Very suddenly she had sat down in the chair. "Well, I'm sick and tired of it," she'd said calmly. "Sick to death." A darkness had rumbled through him. His soul was suffocating in tar. The next morning, Olive spoke to him conversationally. "Jim's car smelled like upchuck last week. Hope he's cleaned it out." Jim O'Casey taught with Olive and for years took both Christopher and Olive to school. "Hope so," said Henry. And in that way, their fight was done.
Elizabeth Strout reading from her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, collection of, 13 linked stories, Olive Kittredge. And here we meet Olive, and she's a force of nature right off the bat.
She
end up understanding her to have all kinds of depths, empathy, and compassion, but her surface is just about as rugged as this is no sweetie pie at home.
This is no sweetie pie, absolutely not. And the joy of writing this book and going through her character was to uncover the different levels and layers of her that I think we all have, although certainly, hopefully not to the extremes that Olive inhabits them.
Introduce us to her a little more thoroughly. I mean, we'll hear more, but who's Olive? Who's Olive Kittredge? Give us a kind of profile of this character who floats through and dominates so many of your stories here.
She's a retired school teacher in a small town on the coast of Maine, and we don't see her in the classroom. We see her during her later years when she's going through a number of changes and a number of losses throughout the different stories that are linked, and yet I think have the sense of an arc of a novel, so that by the end we've seen her through quite a few changes. And she has one son. She's very, very close to him. She has this husband, Henry, who puts up with her with great forbearance. And we see her throughout the course of the book in many different ways. We see her some stories. She's not center stage, but rather some other character in town is center stage, and therefore we get to see Olive from a sideway point of view, as we do in small towns. We think we know somebody well, but we don't really. We see them just in a particular way. So it's about Olive, but it's also about the many different sides of her and also about the town itself.
Why linked stories, Elizabeth? I was reading Mary McCauley's blog at the Baltimore Sun, and I have to credit her with thinking of Don Quixote and Tom Jones, and more than those. In a way, the multiple viewpoints that you get with your stories, Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, Harriet Doar's Stones for Ibarra, Why link stories? Why not a novel? You've done the straight-up novel a couple of times.
Right. And it was one of those decisions that came quite spontaneously. I think the unconscious is at work a great deal in the act of writing. And when I first wrote the first Olive story, I just understood somehow immediately that she was going to have her own book, but that it was going to be a book of stories. And I think, looking back, that I probably understood that she is too great a force for the reader to have to deal with on a consistent level, page after page, or in a more traditional sort of linear novel kind of form. That wasn't going to work for Olive. She's very episodic. She's very she's best seen, I think, in these sharp moments. And also, point of view fascinates me, always has. So to be able to give the reader a break from the force of Olive at different points, I could therefore go to a story which was somebody else's story, but Olive had a part in it. And that was just part of what interests me about people, seeing them from different points of view, and also just my sense right away about the form that this book needed to take.
Her son says to her, you can make people feel terrible.
Yeah.
She calls people hellion and moron and flubbed up. Is it scary to write a book that has to, in many ways, I mean, ultimately admirable, but in many ways unlikable main character at the heart of it?
It's an interesting question, because I a number of times I remember, as I was writing it, a number of times I said to myself, don't be careful. Don't be careful. Let it go. Let it rip. Let her, you know, let Olive rip is what I was obviously meaning. So there was some sense of discomfort at times about that, sure. Yeah.
You've succeeded. I'm not sure what the adverb is. Masterfully, horribly, wonderfully. It's great. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with newly minted Pulitzer Prize winner for fiction, Elizabeth Strout, about the book that won her the prize, Olive Kittredge, 13 linked stories set in hardscrabble Maine. Elizabeth Strout, born in Portland, Maine, grew up in New Hampshire and Maine. She joins us today from New York. You may know her earlier novels, Abide With Me and Amy and Isabel. You can read an excerpt of Olive Kittredge at our website, onpointradio.org. It's been out for most of a year. You may well know it well already, and you can join us. And Elizabeth, let's go right to some of our callers, your readers, I guess. Sherry in Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Sherry. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just so delighted to be talking with both of you. Thank you. I love Olive Kittredge. I love the book, and I love her, and I feel like I know every single person in that book and in that town, because you write with such clarity and such compassion. And I have a question for you. First, I just have a comment that, you know, when we first meet her in Pharmacy, she's a very unlikable character. But then in the very next story, she's just a woman of extraordinary strength and caring and an inability to really connect with people in a direct way. And she just won my heart. And I felt for her throughout the book. So I want to thank you for that. I also want to ask you, which one of those stories did you write first?
Oh, good question.
Yes. Okay.
Thanks,
first
Sherry.
Of all, thank you so much for your comments. I'm very happy to hear all of that. The story that I believe I wrote first, and it's hard to always remember exactly because I wrote bits and pieces of them simultaneously, but I believe the very first real Olive story was the one where her son, a little burst, where her son is getting married and she overhears her new daughter-in-law insult her dress, which she's made specially for her son's wedding. And she feels so wounded that she steals her daughter-in-law's bra and one shoe from her. And that story came to me rather quickly.
Just to make her daughter-in-law's life a little less flawless.
Exactly.
If she has problems now, so does her daughter-in-law.
That's right.
Her bra's gone, so is her shoe. And she uses a magic marker to mark up one of her sweaters
that
she won't find for months, but there you go.
That's right. She thought her daughter-in-law was a little too self-confident. And she thought maybe this could make her feel less so. That came to me rather quickly, and I believe that that was the first Olive story. Once I saw her at the very beginning of that story, I had this image of the woman standing by the picnic table, feeling tired, thinking, everybody can go home now. The day's over. The wedding's over. Please go home. And once I saw that, kind of was off and running with her.
She thinks to herself, as you write, Olive does, Christopher, her son, doesn't need to be living with a woman who thinks she knows everything. Nobody knows everything. They shouldn't think they do, like where their bra is or where their shoe is.
Exactly, exactly.
And the second story that Sherry talks about, Incoming Tide, I mean, here's, you know, where she, here's Kevin Coulson sitting in a car staring out at the bay, and
she gets it.
He's got a rifle in the back seat.
That's right.
He's planning to kill himself.
And Olive has an intuition about this. She is a deeply perceptive person, not so much when it comes to herself or to her own family members, perhaps, but certainly she has an aspect of her that is very intuitive, very sharp, actually without judgment. Even though she's very judgmental, she has this part of her that's without judgment and seems to understand what he might be up to.
Did you feel yourself amping up the struggle, the turmoil in human life in the process of writing this? Is that just part and parcel of writing? I mean, he's sitting in his car with a rifle in the backseat planning to kill himself. Olive, his mother had committed suicide in the kitchen years ago. Yes. Olive sits down with him, tells him that her father committed suicide, and they're talking about Patty Howe, who's had several miscarriages and is depressed. I mean, right. And that's just in, you know, sitting down in one little moment in a car.
Right. And yet I think the story is about the reaffirmation of life, really, or the affirmation of life. Did I amp up depressing things? No, you know, I tried to write organically what was going on. I didn't plan out the stories particularly. They came to me, and I was moved by the concept of somebody like Kevin, and I read a great deal about suicide so that I would be able to imagine his character more fully, and Olive, I sort of already knew that she would be onto this, and so it was really my way of showing Olive catching on to the sadness that some people carry with them.
Some people, maybe a lot of people, that the Patty with miscarriages comes out to collect flowers on the cliff, and before you know it, she's
for
in the drink, and Kevin, who was going to shoot himself, is saving her,
and there we are.
Life's a rumble.
But it turns out to be a good thing.
Let's get a call from Kristen in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Hi, Kristen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And
yeah.
I just recently finished Olive Kittredge, and it was something. At times, I felt like I was, you know, just tolerating Olive, and then through the story, it just developed into what I felt was kind of like a friendship. You know, once you get to know somebody,
exactly,
and different aspects of their life. But I will admit, at times, I kind of felt like putting the book down and walking away from it, just with, because so much, or at times it was just kind of painful to really feel what some of these characters were going through in their lives.
Give us a moment that was just absolutely too painful, Kristen, for you, when you almost dropped it.
Well, it was, I guess, dealing with some of the marriage relationships. You know, a lot of people just weren't fulfilled, you know, and
right,
had grown apart, and there was a lack of communication, and you know, they kind of felt like, you know, gosh, you know, I'm lacking something in my life. I need to go searching for it. One of the really hard times was when the young widow found out from her tenant that you know, her husband had cheated on her, and she'd nursed him through this terrible illness, you know, which he eventually died from, and it was like, oh gosh,
right,
a trial. But Olive comes in, you know, and she just isn't
she felt sorry for her too.
It was a tough moment and an amazing moment. Kristen, thanks for that. I wonder, Elizabeth, if you'd read a little bit from that. I mean, talk about tough here. Marlene
absolutely
finds out that her husband, who's just died, had been cheating on her with a cousin, Carrie.
That's right, Carrie.
And there's this amazing
Marlene
moment. Yeah, and they're sitting, I think it's on the day of the funeral.
Yeah.
And Carrie, they're in a bedroom in the house. Carrie's sort of conked out on the bed. And Marlene is sitting there with something special in her lap, contemplating, we will hear shortly what she's contemplating. Could you read a little bit from the Basket of Trips?
Absolutely. Across the room, facing her, Marlene sits like an obedient schoolgirl in a straight-backed chair by Carrie's double bed, her hands folded in her lap, her plump ankles crossed neatly. On the bed sprawls Carrie. She lies on her stomach with the abandonment of a sunbather, her face turned toward the wall, elbows out, but her hips are turned slightly so that the black outline of her suit seems to accentuate the rise of her rear end, and her black stockinged legs are sleek, in spite of the fact that the stockings are shredded in a series of tiny runs at her feet. "Is she asleep?" Olive asks, walking farther into the room. "Passed out," Marlene answers. "Upchecked first in Eddie's room, then fell asleep here." "I see. Well, it's a nice place you've given her here." Olive walks over toward the little dining alcove and brings back a chair, sits down by Marlene. For a while, neither woman speaks. Then Marlene says pleasantly, "I've been thinking about killing Carrie." She raises a hand from her lap and exposes a small paring knife lying on her green flowered dress. "Oh," says Olive. Marlene bends over the sleeping Carrie and touches the woman's bare neck. "Isn't this some major vein?" she asks, and puts the knife flat against Carrie's neck, even poking slightly at the vague throbbing of the pulse there. "Yeah, okay, might want to be a little careful there." Olive sits forward. In a moment, Marlene sighs, sits back. "Okay, here," she says, and she hands the paring knife to Olive. "Do better with a pillow," Olive tells her. "Cut her throat, there's going to be a lot of blood." A sudden, soft, deep eruption of a giggle comes from Marlene. "Never thought of a pillow," she said. "I've had some time to think about pillows," Olive says, but Marlene nods vacantly like she's not really listening. "Mrs. Kittredge," she asks, "did you know?" "Know what?" says Olive, but she feels her stomach turn choppy, white caps in her stomach. "What Carrie told me today? She said it happened with her and Ed only once, just one time, but I don't believe that. It had to be more. The summer after Ed Jr. graduated from high school." Marlene has started to cry, is shaking her head. Olive looks away. A woman needs her privacy. She holds the paring knife in her lap and gazes out through the window above the bed. Only gray sky and gray ocean, too high up to see any shoreline, only gray water and sky out there, far as the eye can see.
Elizabeth Strout reading from her story, Basket of Trips, in Olive Kittredge. Oh my gosh, I've been thinking about killing Carrie, says Marlene on funeral day. Little paring
sweet
knife
Marlene.
In the lap of her green flower dress, and helpful Olive saying, "Do better with a pillow."
Right.
Very nice.
Just a conversation between two women.
But as our caller says, at the heart of a lot of the difficulty here is relationship difficulty, marital difficulty. Is it the core difficulty, just because we humans are hard to get along with in small town life? I mean, you've got people in the ocean.
Well, I can't speak for all small towns, and I don't think that marital difficulties just in small towns.
Certainly
either.
Not.
I think that it shows up in this book more as a way to convey the imperfection of how we love. We do love deeply and passionately, but we do love imperfectly, Lord knows. And I think that I was interested in that and interested in how well-meaning people can simply miss each other in certain ways and not be headed toward the same thing.
You have said that the job of a writer is to be as honest about what it means to be human as we can bear to be.
Yes.
Where do you find the most difficulty in that honesty? And how honest are human beings in regular life? Are we half honest, one quarter, one tenth? I mean, if it's your job to look at it with the blinkers, you know, all off, what does ordinary life look like?
Exactly.
Lie.
Not quite. Here's what I think. I think that from a very young age, we are taught to use language in a distorted way, and therefore our feelings are distorted. For example, if a little child says in anger or frustration, "I hate my brother," then of course the mother says, "You do not hate your brother." And I'm not saying that she shouldn't be admonishing the child to, we're trying to live in a civilized way. But what I am saying is that this happens again and again for years and years and years until our feelings that we have expressed at a young age in their most primitive form, they've been retaught, and we have to. And I think what happens is we end up not really knowing what we feel sometimes and not really knowing our emotions and therefore not being able to be fully compassionate to somebody else. Because if we don't know what we're feeling, then we're going to have trouble knowing what somebody else is feeling. So I really do think that we go to fiction or poetry or literature to find that sentence that's either muscular enough or felicitous enough to return us to the truthfulness and clarity of what we did once know about human emotions in ourselves and then in other people.
You know, I had a writing teacher years ago, a pretty prominent fiction editor, and I was surprised by his advice. It was a college setting. You know, everyone comes in thinking it's about the words and how you put them together. And, of course, there's that. But his instruction was, you know, just write a first short story about something and be completely honest. Just be completely honest. First of all, to dig down and figure out what that means. But if you do that, it will read like a magic. And secondly, no matter how weird it is, it will be universal.
That's right. And it's so hard. I see this in myself, and I see this having taught writing for many years. People will say, oh, I want to be honest. I'll write something honest. But it's so hard. It's really quite surprisingly difficult to write down those things that we feel ashamed about. That's really what it comes down to. And I think that we don't need to, for the most part, feel ashamed of many of these things because we are human and it will be universal.
It's a shame that even the nuances of the shame, everybody somehow knows them. It's like the underground telegraph that we're all hooked into. Let's get a call from Virginia, a little south of Maine, Vienna, Virginia, and Mary Jane. Hi, Mary Jane. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. This is really wonderful to speak to, Elizabeth. I loved Olive Kittredge. I read it a number of months ago, and listening to the two of you just speak now makes me have even more questions, but I won't do that to everybody else. About the universal theme, I think you really hit the mark on the honesty and universal themes, because when I read it, I connected so deeply to it, particularly to Olive, because she's so much like my own mother. And her marriage with Henry is so much like my father and her.
Mary Jane, I can't just let that pass. Olive was like your mother. I don't know what to say to you exactly. Condolences or, wow, you sound pretty well adjusted for that storm you came through?
She and I have now that I've gotten older and come to a better understanding, these wonderful stories have helped me have a greater appreciation of her and her humanity.
I'm so glad.
For a long time, I was very angry and alienated.
Yes.
But then
yes.
I realized through Olive, which is kind of funny in a lot of ways, she's very human, though, and she doesn't necessarily mean to come across the way she does. They're just very sure of themselves.
Right, right.
Oh, go on. I'm sorry.
No, you're the one calling in with the question.
It's just so exciting to actually talk to someone who kind of gets a person like that.
Yeah.
Because Tom's reaction of, geez, I don't know whether to offer you condolences or whatever.
Right.
But it's true. It's a very that's a very complicated personality.
That's right.
Well, our storybook image of the great mother is the sweet and serene mother. And then here you've got, you know, the ultimate stormy mood mother, and yet she bangs on through to clarity, to honesty, and to a kind of empathy. Our time is short before the break, Mary Jane. Thank you so much for your call. But Elizabeth, that's a gift, too, though it's not such an easy one to take.
It's I'm very happy to hear that she understands her mother better as a result of reading about Olive. That's exactly what – that's lovely.
Stormy moods and sudden, deep laughter. Was that your mom or a little bit?
Oh, it was part of I grew up with a lot of Maine relatives, and there's a lot of – different people in all of
Maine place. We've got to talk about that when we come back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Pulitzer Prize winner for fiction 2009, Elizabeth Strout, about her book that won the Pulitzer Prize, Olive Kittredge, 13 linked stories set in Small town, hardscrabble, coastal Maine. Molly Gloss, reviewing Olive Kittredge in the Washington Post, says, impatience, regret, and even repugnance run like seams of coal through her marriage to Henry, the good-natured town pharmacist. And maybe not only through that marriage, but people come out kind of seeing a little more clearly, and it's wonderful. Let's get a call from Susan in Cohasset, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air with Elizabeth Strout.
Hi,
what do you think?
Hi, Susan.
Hi. I live in a small town, too, and I read Olive last summer, and I just found it to be intensely vivid. I remember the people as if they're my own relatives at this point. And as I go about my life in my little small town, I try, like Olive, to have a little more fair bearance with the people I meet. Try not to make such snap decisions.
Your small town and your coastal town, did you recognize types in this book, Susan? You're a little south of Maine, but not so far.
I definitely recognize types, and wonderful types, and types that maybe you'd want to avoid. Mm-hmm. But for myself, just not trying to make such quick decisions about what I feel about somebody or what type they are. But like how I felt about Olive, like I made a snap decision about her when I started reading the book. But as I continued to read, I grew to like her more and understand her more and have much more sympathy for her.
Susan, that's right. Great. Elizabeth, the desired effect here?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Although whatever the effect is, it belongs, you know, the book belongs to the reader. But I'm always gratified to hear that somebody can take away from this book or any book that I write the idea that we are all so much more complicated than we appear to be, and that we're mostly just doing the best that we can. And so I'm glad if you're able to walk around town with a bit of a lighter heart.
Here's a question from the website onpointradio.org from Sam about influences, and he asks if the story Basket of Trips, which we heard there, the paring knife in the lap and the passed out cousin on the bed who she just might want to jab in a juggler. Mm-hmm. He said he wonders if the story was inspired by Hitchcock. The sort of glum sense of humor with which the characters contemplate murder remind him very much of a conversation from, say, Rope or The Trouble with Harry.
That's so interesting. I certainly love Hitchcock. I've never been aware of being influenced by him. But, you know, I think that a writer, or like speaking for myself, one never really knows where the influence is happening or what is coming, what's churning around in that unconscious. It's always a surprise to me in some ways to find what I've put down on the page. So I don't consciously have any knowledge of being influenced by Hitchcock as much as the dryness of the New England rhythm in both speech and action and the sort of matter-of-factness of what would otherwise be highly dramatic moments.
Go, stay in that vein, if you would, and go to Place and Maine. I mean, I loved that the images from that very opening passage, as you wrote about the snowy roads and rainy roads and the smell of the pines and the heavy salt air as he drives near the Maine coast. But what about this particular place and its significance here?
Well, Olive Kittredge is very much a part of this place. She's very much a part. I sort of think of her as like a barnacle, in the sense that she's not leaving town. Her son might, but she's certainly not. And her ancestors have been there for many, many generations, as have Henry's. And so there's a certain kind of pride that comes from that for them. And I think it's changing. The world is changing. And certainly toward the end of the book, that becomes more apparent that more summer people are coming in. You know, the world, we all know, is changing very rapidly. But for Olive Kittredge, who's aging, she's confused and frightened by the idea that there would be any other place for her offspring to live than this beautiful, beautiful coastline that's been her home and her ancestors' home. And there is something about the Maine voice and the kind of dryness and sort of flatness that's very much inside me since I grew up with it, that I think is part of the sound of this book.
But in the writing, as at least as I kind of get your bio, you were probably in New York for most of the writing of these
very main plays.
What was that like? Did it mean stretching your mind back to girlhood, childhood? Are you back there often enough that you've got, you know, updates on how it feels and smells and the people walk?
I think that by living in New York for so many years, and I love New York, and by living here for so many years, I think that it has actually heightened my memories of Maine. I do go back there, yes, but I think that it left me with a kind of low-boil sense of homesickness or nostalgia, particularly for the physical world of Maine, the beauty, that first paragraph of Henry driving in the car, that's a beauty that I can remember myself and love and miss. So, but a lot of this book actually was also written in Provincetown, Massachusetts. I rented a cottage for the summer, and a number of these stories were written there, which was kind of interesting because the front room looked right out onto these lobster pots and a lobster fisherman and a German shepherd. It could have been right out of my childhood. It was sort of funny.
But images here that really wouldn't have come from any other coastal place. I mean, in the very first story, you've got Denise going on about the wonderment of her boyfriend or new husband. They're out at night. They're digging potatoes the headlights of their car at night. Nighttime digging is a kind of ecstatic experience.
Okay. Oh, it is.
We're in Maine.
Oh, I dug potatoes by moonlight as a child, and it truly is ecstatic.
I don't know potatoes
lovely.
Well enough to know why. Is it to get the harvest in quickly? You dig 24 hours. Why at night?
I can't remember why it was at night. It was at a friend's house. A friend had a farm, and not sure why we were doing it at night. Maybe we didn't have time to do it during the day. I can't quite remember that. But
moonlight
but
potato
the
digging,
is
your
so
fingers
deep.
Down in the earth. I mean, potatoes it's lovely. Such a visceral thing. Getting
it
the
is really
out.
Lovely. Was it's, lovely.
Yeah. Let's go to Sarah in Manchester, Connecticut. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah. And Elizabeth, it's an honor to talk to you and to I wanted to comment on the chapter in Olive Kittredge with the anorexic girl. I have a 20-year history of anorexia. And 5 hospitalizations later, Olive Kittredge said the exact thing that I think any anorexic woman would want to hear to the anorexic girl. She was just so commanding and so... We are going to take care of this.
Right.
Do you wish you had an Olive Kittredge who kind of step into your anorexic experience and what, just set you straight? Is it that easy?
Well, you know what it was she wasn't angry at the anorexic girl, and this girl was a real hellion. But she, you know, and being anorexic myself, I get a lot of lectures and in fact, my mother read the book. She said, honey, did that chapter bother you? You know, Olive seemed almost kind of mean, but no, it didn't. It made me wish that somebody had a big, broad hand to lay on my back and say, we're going to take care of this. You know, and the fact that the girl died, I loved that because that is the very real side of a disease that many people don't understand. But boy, Elizabeth, you do.
Unfortunately, it is certainly a part of that. Boy, I wish you all the best with your struggles with that.
These issues aren't just in Storyland, as Sarah says right here.
Yeah, right, exactly. And when Olive says, I'm starving too, there's the odd way that she would connect with the girl.
What does she mean by that, though? Because here's Olive. She's this kind of big, strapping...
She's
nothing
starving,
like anorexic.
Sure.
Donuts are one of her favorites. Are we talking about her soul, or she's just ready for lunch?
I think we're talking about her soul, that she has endless hunger for love as well.
Sarah, thank you very much for your call.
Yes, thank you, Sarah, for sharing that.
Good luck with that. Steve in Dracut, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Oh, God, thank you. To follow the anorexic discussion, I gave up drugs 3 years ago, 38 years of drug addiction, and I turned off my television at the same time in the pursuit of honesty, in the pursuit of, you know, more meaningful spirituality in my life, hoping it would help me through drug addiction. And I walk into Barnes & Noble, and I see this yellow book, and it just intrigued me. I can't explain why. I picked it up, and the integrity, the honesty that book gave me, the understanding of how people really feel beneath the surface, Elizabeth, was as big a NA meeting I've been to or any counseling session I've been to, when Denise sits on the steps at the end of that chapter, the piano player, I believe her name, and she talks about, I'm not so bad. I'm no worse than any of these other people that counsel.
Right, Angie.
Right. It's just so thrilling to know that somebody understands what really goes on beneath the surface of life, what people really feel. Olive saying, I'm starving myself, speaking of what she's missing in her own life. It's not
right.
About food, it's about human connection.
Right.
I went on and I read Amy and Isabel. I've read it three times. Read with me. I've read Henry Miller. I've read some of the real powerhouses. But what you give to this literature world is second to none. And I want to thank you for being on the planet, how you've really helped me through surviving drug addiction. I've been clean for 3 years, and it's an amazing thing to tell you that you wrote a book and you weren't trying to help drug addicts, but you did.
Wow.
Oh, it's an amazing thing to hear. That's wonderful to hear. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is great testimony, Steve.
Fabulous. Thank you so much.
Pulitzer earned, Elizabeth. And more than that, Steve, thank you so much.
Yes, that's lovely.
Here's another. In that vein, Bobby online writes, everyone needs a friend like Olive Kittredge, someone to strip away the falseness, the masks Steve talks about.
Exactly.
But that's not always an easy friend to have.
No, it's not an easy friend to have. That's probably one reason that we need books, so that we can put them down. Like there had been an earlier caller saying that she sometimes needed to put it down or wanted to put it down. So I think there's the plus about having it within two covers.
You're such a wonderful reader. I'd love to get one more, and it's really right from the very end of the very last story. Olive's been through a lot. People around her have been through a lot. Henry, the pharmacist, her husband we met at the beginning, is dead and gone. She's taken up with a new man.
Yes.
And she's still in the game. Could you read?
Absolutely. She watched him, looked away, looked at him again. To sit down beside him would be to close her eyes to the gaping loneliness of this sunlit world. God, I'm scared, he said quietly. She almost said, oh, stop, I hate scared people. She would have said that to Henry, to just about anyone, maybe because she hated the scared part of herself. This was just a fleeting thought. There was a contest within her, revulsion and tentative desire. It was the sudden memory of Jane Holton in the waiting room that caused Olive to walk to the bed, the freedom of that ordinary banter because Jack, in the doctor's office, had needed her, had given her a place in the world. His blue eyes were watching her now. She saw in them the vulnerability, the invitation, the fear, as she sat down quietly, placed her open hand on his chest, felt the thump, thump of his heart, which would someday stop, as all hearts do. But there was no someday now. There was only the silence of this sunny room. They were here, and her body, old, big, sagging, felt straight-out desire for his. That she had not loved Henry this way for many years before he died saddened her enough to make her close her eyes. What young people didn't know, she thought, lying down beside this man, his hand on her shoulder, her arm. Oh, what young people did not know. They did not know that lumpy, aged, and wrinkled bodies were as needy as their own young, firm ones, that love was not to be tossed away carelessly, as if it were a tart on a platter with others that got passed around again. No, if love was available, one chose it or didn't choose it. And if her platter had been full with the goodness of Henry, and she had found it burdensome, had flicked it off crumbs at a time, it was because she had not known what one should know, that day after day was unconsciously squandered. And so, if this man next to her now was not a man she would have chosen before this time, what did it matter? He most likely wouldn't have chosen her either. But here they were, and Olive pictured two slices of Swiss cheese pressed together, such holes they brought to this union, what pieces life took out of you. Her eyes were closed, and throughout her tired self swept waves of gratitude and regret. She pictured the sunny room, the sun-washed wall, the bayberry outside. It baffled her, the world. She did not want to leave it yet.
Olive Kittredge. Still in the game there, Elizabeth Strout reading from her Pulitzer Prize-winning book. And that's a wonderful image. I get that. That's a brand new one for me. But the two lovers with warts and wrinkles and bumps and all, but pressing together in love like two slices of Swiss cheese with all the holes, the pieces
all
taken,
the holes that life takes out of us.
Wow, that is pretty great. That is pretty great. What was it like when you got the Pulitzer call? That's a great endorsement.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. It was a surprise. And I have to tell you, it's just lovely. It's like a lightning of air all around me is how it feels.
All around you, and we're feeling it right now. The honesty you bring to this is terrific, and you can hear everybody responding to it in our callers today.
I mean, wonderful to hear the callers.
It is, isn't it? And everybody, we see so much more than we say, or that sometimes even let ourselves think. I mean, the people who actually acknowledge and articulate what we see and apprehend as Olive here, that they seem almost like mystics or mediums or magicians. But it's just
right.
It's just kind of a real honesty.
Yes, and we don't really know what it feels like to be another person, and I think that books can provide one way of having a momentary experience of what it feels like to be somebody else, and I think that we're perhaps not quite as different from one another as we think.
Or 13 momentary experiences when they're linked together in 13 stories. It's a terrific, and I enjoyed it enormously, and just enjoyed talking with you a lot, Elizabeth. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's been wonderful. It's been wonderful to talk with you as well. Thank you so much.
Elizabeth Strout, author of Olive Kittredge, winner of the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for fiction. She joined us from New York. Her earlier novels are Abide With Me and Amy and Isabel. You can read an excerpt of Olive Kittredge at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can continue the conversation there as well, or on Twitter. Find us there and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. With help from Kathy Corman and Sam Sanders, our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.